Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, much of the mass media has fixated on whether the film Zero Dark Thirty glorified torture. We'll explore the realities of torture, both in the broader context and among individual survivors. Then on the Scholar Circle, President Obama has announced that a decade of war is now ending. Our panel argues that warring is a relatively new phenomenon in human societies. This past week, Academy Award-winning director Catherine Bigelow has been forced by critics to explain her use of graphic, detailed torture scenes in the film Zero Dark Thirty, which dramatizes the hunt and assassination of Osama bin Laden. But while the headlines and talk shows focus on Bigelow and her film, less has been said about new reports detailing extensive torture or about the realities of torture. Two of the reports issued by the United Nations say that the use of torture had risen in Afghan police jails over the past year, and that such practices escalated in the troubled African country Mali. British soldiers are also facing a round of new charges of torture, and Britain itself is accused of a systemic policy of abuse committed over the years 2003 to 2008. What happens to people who are tortured? That's the subject of a new documentary called Tortured, Stories of Survival. With us is the filmmaker Murad Aldin Amire and one of his interviewees within the film, Hector Aristizabal. Gerald Gray is also with us. He is a social worker and psychotherapist who works with torture victims and who has initiated numerous institutes to assist them, including the Center for Justice and Accountability. Welcome to the three of you. Murad, I want to start with you. You've got five subjects, and they had parallel lives, a lot in common. How would you distinguish them, and how do you weave their stories together?
These five individuals, they come from different backgrounds, different walks of life, different generations even, different time periods, different countries, different cultures. The only similarity is in the methods that were used and in the effects that it had on them as survivors of torture. That's something that I learned in going through the process as the filmmaker, is that I was assuming that I was going to hear five completely different stories. One of them is a POW who was in Vietnam, and one is a Palestinian, who was tortured in Israel, and people from all over the world. So I was assuming I was going to hear five completely different stories. And they were five different lead-ins to the story, but once it really came down to it, it's almost like it was methodic. There was a system and a structure that was being used, like out of a textbook, like all of these torturers took a class together or something, and they were implementing very, very similar methods and techniques. So when I saw those similarities in the stories, then I said, okay, I have to emphasize this. Hector, who was tortured in Colombia in the 70s, in the 70s?
82.
In the early 80s, went through very similar techniques as Dr. Philip Butler, who was tortured in a Vietnamese prison camp as a POW in the early 70s, 10 years earlier. And Salah Sarsour went through a similar methods in Israel in the 90s. And then Abdullah al-Maliki went through similar techniques in Syria in 2004. There's a pattern. It was a learning experience for me to see that they were all experiencing the same things regardless of where, by who, when, what was the reason they were being tortured. It didn't matter. The same things were happening to them and the same results were coming out.
So those who are engaging in the use of torture are learning from each other about what works.
They're networking somehow. They know the same techniques.
Hector, give us a sense of what you went through and how you recovered. You've really recovered in a way that I don't know a lot of torture victims do.
What Murad was describing is also what people are getting more and more familiar with, the kinds of movies that we're watching every day, with the TV programs that we're watching everywhere, with the School of the Americas, which is a school in Fort Benning, Georgia, where many torturers had been trained, especially torturers from South and Central America. I think that almost any U.S. citizen can become a torturer tomorrow. They had been taught by our culture how to inflict pain, how to humiliate, how to degrade the humanity of another person. And I think that that's one of the main things that we need to address, because these films are not addressing not only what happens to the torture survivor after the torture, but to the torturer as well, and to the society that allows torture to exist. Because torture, and you can hear this from torturers, from interrogators, is the worst way of gathering intelligence. It is not useful for gathering intelligence. When you are tortured, you will say or do anything you think is going to stop the pain or is going to keep you alive. So in my case, I created a whole story about someone who was not the person they thought that they had caught. And I was lucky for a series of circumstances that allowed me to do that. But torture is used very effectively to create terror, in the community, in the population. So that's why films like Zero Dark Thirty and 24 are sending the message to people who are different colors of the people inflicting the torture that this might happen to you. And we don't care if you are Al-Qaeda, if you know anything important, we are going to torture you. So almost anyone now knows how to use waterboarding, except perhaps our leaders. I sent a letter to Vice President Cheney that I will be happy to pay my dues and come and show waterboarding on him or anyone in Congress. Unfortunately, they didn't respond to that. But I really wanted to do that because the way these people
was
talk.
Was that one of the techniques that was used on you, waterboarding?
Yeah, waterboarding, electricity, heatings all over the place. I was lucky that they didn't cut my body. They didn't take my eyes out as they did to so many people in South and Central America because it happened during the presidential elections in Colombia in 1982. So we have international delegates visiting the country. And that's why the three of us who were being tortured at that moment were able to survive. Many people before me and after me, just the week after me, a neighbor was found on a ditch with his eyes out because he was cross-eyed and they took his eyes out. So that could have happened to me, and that happened, unfortunately, to my brother in 1999, many years later, when he was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by the paramilitary death squads. Now, the second part of your question, I, like any other human being, have gone through ordeals in my life, and torture is one of them. This is not the main one. And our job as human beings is not just to be victims or survivors. Our job is to find meaning in the things that happen to us. I was very lucky to have a community that helped me to go, to have access to psychoanalysis, to have access to rituals, but mainly to have access to art. In my case, theater is what has allowed me to resignify what happened to me and to continue being an activist in a way that serves me. So when Abu Ghraib, the photos show the same techniques that the film depicts from all over the place. When Abu Ghraib came out, I decided to do a play about my experience with torture and the death of my brother and show people in the United States that this was something that had been happening for many years, that it wasn't something new, that it wasn't just a bad apples in Abu Ghraib that decided to be unsupervised and torture people, that this had been a consistent policy of the United States for many years.
Gerald Gray, let's bring you in. How common is Hector's story?
In terms of surviving, it's one of the best stories that I've heard. We know from the clinical work with survivors, I'm a therapist and I've worked with survivors for over 20 years, that three main things help initially with torture. What the person was before torture, how strong, how well put together, what kind of support they had while in prison, if any, and what support they had after prison. The first and third are probably the most important. Sometimes, though, there are cellmates who help or leaders in the prison block or something like that. But it varies a lot as to one whether one can recover or not. And often it's a partial recovery that can be set back by triggers. Any kind of reminder of the torture can induce, again, post-traumatic stress symptoms, even testifying in court against the torturer. If he's caught, can bring you face-to-face with that person for a good reason, but it can induce, it's a trigger, and it can induce for a while the symptoms that you suffered. Torture builds distrust in other people. That's an effect that's natural to it, and it's often intended. So a person has to feel safe, first of all, after torture, and then they have to get support of various kinds. Hector got probably the maximum support that I've seen with any torture survivor, and that's very good. But most people don't get that, so they live often with symptoms for a long time. And I'm talking just about the people that I've seen in clinic who came in voluntarily to do something about their torture. There are many people, majority of torture victims, don't have that opportunity, and if they have it, they don't take it because they're afraid of authority. They're afraid to trust other people. They're afraid to be reported in some way. It's a devastating after effect. It can be overcome, though. A lot depends on what the country does.
Mourad, let's turn back to you, because you follow five people, and they all really recovered in some kind of a healthy way. How did you decide on these particular five, and do you feel like you left part of the story out in your film?
Well, let me back up first and say I actually interviewed 13 survivors, along with psychologists and experts on the topic. But with the survivors themselves, I interviewed 13. The reason why these five are in the film and the other ones are not, some of those 13 eliminated themselves voluntarily. Halfway through the interview, they decided they didn't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Or they would finish the interview and email me a week later or call me a week later and say, you know, I really can't. I'm sorry. I know I already signed the release, but I just don't want my story out there. That did happen. It happened a lot. So some of the narrowing down to those five, you know, came that way. The rest, if somebody is still healing, and this is something that I noticed, if somebody is still in that process of healing and trying to understand what happened to them and deal with it, most of them are not really ready to share their story publicly. They're still trying to deal with it within themselves. So anybody who's willing to get in front of a camera and share their story publicly in the first place probably has already gone through some sort of healing process. So the five in the film, in the documentary film that I've done, have already gone through that process of dealing with it internally. And they've reached a point where they can now share it publicly. I would say with the exception of one gentleman, after I did the interview with him, he told me that that was the first time that he shared his story with anybody outside of his own family. And he is in the film. He chose to go ahead and keep his story in the film.
Just a reminder that the film is called The Torture, Stories of Survival. Let me thank the three of you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Mourad Aldin Almayreh is the filmmaker, and his film is called The Tortured. And Hector Aristobal is a theater artist and psychologist. Gerald Gray is a social worker and psychotherapist who works with torture victims and who has initiated numerous institutes to assist them. Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're speaking in light of the media's fixation on Catherine Bigelow's film Zero Dark Thirty about the realities of torture. We're joined now by Pamela Merchant, who is executive director of the Center for Justice and Accountability. Gerald Gray is also with us. He is a social worker and psychotherapist who works with torture victims and who has initiated numerous institutes to assist them, including the Center for Justice and Accountability. Also with us is Stephen Rohde. He's a constitutional lawyer, chair of the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation of Southern California, and author of American Words of Freedom and Freedom of Assembly.
Thank you so much for being with us. What I'm trying to get at here really is the realities of torture, both in the broad sense, such as where is it being used, by whom, why, what kind, if we're making progress legally in diminishing the practice, and it's been 4 years nearly to the day that President Obama signed the order to end the use of torture, but then on the personal level too, what the effect is really on individuals, on victims, societies, and maybe even the perpetrators themselves. Starting with the big picture, Pamela Merchant, give us a sense of where, by whom, why, and what kind of legal progress we're seeing.
Torture is something that's been around, sadly, since the 11th century or earlier. And the United States signed onto the Convention Against Torture right after World War II. And since 1948, when the UN convention was first issued, 144 nations have committed to end torture. But sadly, just last year, according to Amnesty International, over 100 nations commit torture today. And as we all know, in the United States, our government was one of those countries that started through the harsh interrogation program at Guantanamo. On the progress front, we've definitely made progress here in the United States. Obviously, I believe that the Obama administration no longer sanctions the use of torture in the post-9/11 context. But there are many people here who still are calling for its use, and as we know from the movie Zero Dark Thirty, there's even the suggestion that torture is a useful way for gathering information, and that, in fact, led us in part to finding Osama bin Laden.
Your organization has been taking torture perpetrators to court on behalf of torture victims and their families. Can you give us a couple of examples of how you even found the perpetrators and how those cases turned out?
Our founder is on the call with us today, Jerry Gray, but the U.S. government estimates that there are over 500,000 torture survivors in the United States. That's a very low estimate. Survivors often live in the same community with their abusers. Our first case involved Bosnia, so an individual who had been tortured in a Bosnian detention camp and was living in the same community with his torturer. A prominent case that we've just successfully tried in February was against the former Minister of Defense from Somalia, who lives in Fairfax, Virginia, and was head of all the military there during the Syed Bari regime, where tens of thousands of people were killed and tens of thousands of people were imprisoned, and many were tortured. So we're a nation of immigrants and refugees, and we give asylum to survivors from countries where governments have oppressed the people. And then yet, sadly, often the perpetrators are allowed in too. So often the perpetrators are from the same communities that are here. So there are a large Salvadoran population. We've had, for instance, a number of cases involving like the killing of Archbishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador, the 1989 massacre of six Jesuit priests and their housekeeper and her daughter. So those are the types of communities that we're working with here. And obviously the Khmer Rouge, a large number of survivors in the diaspora from Cambodia here.
Gerald Gray, since she prompted you, is there anything you'd want to add?
Yes, that is, among clinical studies of degree of torture among refugees, they're very consistent. From countries where torture is used, at least 20% of those refugees will have been tortured. They're here.
Stephen Rohde, are you seeing any progress now in terms of law?
It's a dark picture, really. Before 9/11, we cannot say the United States had a clean slate as far as torture is concerned. First of all, we are the hosts of the School of the Americas, in which torturers were trained and returned to their countries in South America and elsewhere. That school has changed its name, but not its training. We've had incidents across the board of torture in American prisons through indefinite detention and other forms of torture. But at least in the United States before 9/11, there was a broad consensus against torture, regardless of any debate over whether it works or doesn't work, that torture is wrong, immoral, and illegal. Unfortunately, in the last 11 years since 9/11, there's been a paradigm shift. And the movie Zero Dark Thirty is a lens, literally, through which we now can judge this. Because the one thing there's no controversy about in Zero Dark Thirty is that it accurately depicts the United States government, through the CIA in that film, torturing, engaging in waterboarding, sexual humiliation, and other forms of torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Now, that's a fact. That is such a fact that it will be emblazoned in a movie and distributed around the world. And so what we have to ask ourselves is, how did this happen? How has a new normal been created which tolerated torture and authorized it and used it? And in the Obama administration, how can it be explained that no prosecutions, no investigations, not even a commission has been appointed in the last 4 years to document and investigate what went on in the Bush administration in terms of torture and other forms of human rights violations?
Steve Rohde, as I understand it, President Obama had signed that order 4 years ago to end the use of torture. To your knowledge, has the U.S. ended its practice?
To my knowledge, is a knowledge based on only what the government will disclose and various lawsuits to try to discover what, if anything, is happening in various CIA black sites and in other facilities around the world. We kind of only can hope that under this president, he has kept his promise. Other presidents have lied to the American people about torture. I can't point to evidence today of the kind of torture that went on in the past, so that may be a good step. But unfortunately, Guantanamo Bay remains open, despite President Obama's pledge, and of course he was frustrated by Congress largely in closing Guantanamo. But the failure of accountability is what worries me. What's wonderful about your other guests is their steadfast work in holding people accountable for torture. And yet, widespread torture in the name of the United States is now documented and admitted and even pridefully announced in George Bush's memoirs. But this nation stands mute and immobile in any effort to hold them accountable.
In the Obama administration, this is just me speculating, in his first 4 years, he tried really hard not to rock the boat in order to try to get some other agenda items across. He does not seem to be willing to do that anymore. I wonder if now might be the time that he does press forward. But on that accountability matter, one of the trends that I'm starting to notice is a reliance on international institutions. Great Britain is being called to the carpet for its use of torture during the Iraq War. How does that all work together and fit together?
We actually primarily work in national courts using international law, but there has been a very significant change in how the world views accountability since World War II, and it's taken off since the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. The new norm around accountability is that we have an expectation as a people that somebody like Charles Taylor is going to be tried and held to account, that that is a realistic thing that very well may happen. I believe that's been a change, a significant change for the better in modern history. One other point, though, about the point that Stephen was making about how we don't really know what our government has done. There is a document that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, they've done a report on the CIA's detention interrogation program. They reviewed thousands and thousands and thousands of documents and created this giant report that is still not public. And it's been alleged that the CIA has released more information to the people that made the Zero Dark Thirty movie than they have to the American public. So one thing that we can do is really push to get this report released, that we'll really have a true sense of what happened.
Gerald Gray, I want to bring you in now. I mean, you deal with torture victims. I wonder if you can give us a sense of the impact it's having on victims, society.
I should say at the outset that the movie Zero Dark Thirty and many other issues around torture and interrogation mislead the public from the greater issue of torture. In the clinics that have been set up, there are about 25 torture treatment clinics in the country. We have learned for many years that most torture is not for interrogation. Most of it is for control by terror. And in that case, it's used massively. Bodies are left out. People are returned to homes, neighborhoods showing torture. So we need to use the occasion of the movie to focus on torture, but not limit our view to what may be a deliberately misleading focus on interrogation. In terms of the effects, most people who go through torture itself are going to end up with major depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. So it may mean memory loss, difficulty concentrating, use of drugs and alcohol to overcome memories or try to sleep. And in fact, there is sleep disorder. It can lead to suicide. It can lead to homicide. It can lead to domestic violence, which is a lot of what we see from combat veterans who have PTSD. And this can last a lifetime if one lives a full life. So it means that neighborhoods are lost, countries are lost, regions are lost.
You mentioned that it's often used as a means of political control. Governments like Britain or the U.S. engage in torture behind closed doors. What is driving that?
Two things. Interrogation in some cases, but for instance, take Iraq. There were 17 U.S. prisons at one time. There were 50,000 people in those prisons. This is news from various sources that I researched about 6 or 8 years ago. You're not going to interrogate 50,000 people every 6 months or something like that. Those people are released, and in one condition or another, none of it good. That shows people that they are under the thumb of a kind of killing machine. And that controls by terror. It means you can't organize. It means you can't trust other people. It means you feel guilty and ashamed of what happened to you under torture. It means you can't have relationships.
If I may interrupt, the flip side of this is what happens to the torturer, because torturers are also engage in this extraordinary amount of violence. There's more and more research about countries that have not really dealt with the violence that happened, especially in Central America, where the lack of impunity for all the things that happened during the 80s there is well established, and they're extraordinarily violent countries right now. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that if you don't address these issues, you can end up in this situation where the violence cycle never stops.
And so is this one violent? I mean, if you look at what happens to the country in terms of the types of games that are played on video, the kinds of movies that are more and more produced, this is probably more a result of constant exposure to war than it is to anything else.
Well, that brings up two questions, really. One about how to restore a society, but also, is there a psychological profile to people who do engage in torture? Gerald Gray, is there?
Yes, but it's not what people expect. Most people think there will be a sadist behind torture. Torturers are trained from ordinary folk. There are two studies that I would cite. One was a Greek study that came out after the colonels were overthrown a number of years ago, in which regular people in the military were selected out by their superiors to become torturers. And they were put through what is essentially Marine basic training. That is, they were selected because they were very strong, they could withstand pain themselves, they were tortured in the course of the training to torture, which tells them what will happen if it's imposed by them. Some were even permitted in the Greek setting to torture people who were ostensibly superior to them in military rank. They were given special uniforms, special language, names for types of torture, and so on. But there's another type of torturer. The American ones, and not only the American ones in Abu Ghraib, there are hundreds of psychologists in intelligence and military in this country, and they know the Stanford prisons.
Stanford prison experiments.
In the early 70s very well, which proved that if you put people in a setting of prison, they have rank over the prisoners, and they're not given outside observation that they will torture. And the most brutal person on each shift will set the bar. The military can't police itself. The wardens can't police themselves. Without the International Red Cross and the UN looking in on military prisons, it's a setup for very ordinary soldiers eventually to torture. And if anyone's caught, they'll take the blame. And the political advantage to this is there's no paper trail. It's a setup. And torturers can be very ordinary, everyday soldiers in any army.
Back to the question Steve Rohde asked, which is, how did we end up with this as the new normal? How do you think we became the new normal?
I think Gerald put his finger on it, that you can train people for this, but you start with fear and patriotism. And when the end justifies the means, and that post-9/11, all means necessary could be used to vindicate what is seen as an assault on America, then we loosen up the bonds of law, of morality, and we're getting exactly what we're talking about. And yet there is no national consensus. This was not an issue in the recent presidential election. There wasn't a hint of it in President Obama's inaugural address. There's no broad political constituency, except for human rights organizations and others, to bring this to the public's attention and to begin the process. Because if we paper over this dark chapter in American history, if we do not unearth what went on and hold people accountable as well as treat people who are the victims of it, we are going to have hell to pay, because your answer is true. Your question is true. International bodies in Spain and elsewhere are, and Britain and elsewhere, are looking into this. And the lack of American review means that the International Criminal Court and other courts may, if they have the strength and the courage, be the forums in which all of this begins to get exposed.
I would love to have gotten into some of the remedies here. I think we're going to have to do that in a second part at some point in the future. But let me thank the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
Stay tuned.
I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live a bit? It's out on the edge of darkness. There rides a peace chain, a peace chain. Take this country, come take it home again. Peace chain sounding loud, ride on the peace chain. Ooh-wah, ee-ya, ooh-wah. A
come off this chain. It's been pain, holy rope.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. George Orwell wrote about a time of perpetual war for perpetual peace. And war has defined eras and played a central role in our politics and culture. But our next panel argues that warring is not the norm, that it may be a relatively new phenomenon, and that human beings are not warlike by nature. Their research is part of the book War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland and Research Scientist at the University of Arizona. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace, and the editor of War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Darshan Narvaez is professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development, and Personality, Identity, and Character, Explorations in Moral Psychology. R. Brian Ferguson is professor of anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Full Spectrum, The Military Invasion of Anthropology, Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. Thank you so much for being with us. All three of you are that war is really not the norm and that we're not warlike by nature. So let's start with the broad strokes of what and where the evidence is. Doug Fry, let's start with you. You've been studying peaceful societies. Who are they and what do they tell us about humanity?
There are peaceful societies, both internally peaceful, meaning that there's not much violence in the societies, and usually they have an ethic of nonviolence. But for this topic, we're more interested in the non-warring societies. If you look at the cross-cultural database, most societies do engage in war, but some do not. So I guess the basic sort of ground argument here is that if some don't, it's certainly not something that's programmed rigidly into humanity's genes. But for this book, War, Peace, and Human Nature, I sort of take a new slant on this and consider the whole idea of restraint. And I'm talking about restraint against aggression, restraint against physical aggression, and try to contextualize the human animal within the primate order and also within other animal species. And the key idea there, we do an awful lot of avoiding of conflict, period, and sometimes we get into our verbal fights, and we could call those displays, analogous to displays in other animals, but rather very little of our contest behavior, our conflict behavior, actually involves anything physical at all. And this is just something that we all take for granted all the time. We don't expect to be hit as we just go around our lives, generally. We don't expect to be killed or kill anybody. We're really actually a pretty docile species, as are most other primates.
So what you're saying is really it's an anomaly to be physically violent, particularly lethally violent.
Yeah, particularly lethally violent. And here, of course, we're talking about everything, homicide and so forth. We calculate homicide rates in 100,000 per year. And they can range from virtually nothing, less than one per 100,000 per year, up to a so-called high homicide rate of 50 per year. A statistic I came across recently was if you add up during the World War II years in Europe, all of the domestic homicides plus all of the war deaths, it's somewhere in the range of about 500 per year per 100,000, which is like half of 1% of the population being killed during World War II in Europe. So, I mean, even under these extreme situations, that's not a high rate of killing just numerically. Of course, this is tragic for all the people who lost their lives and their loved ones. I don't mean to minimize it in any way. But again, I'm just trying to take a slant on this, which really goes in the face of the types of theories we hear all the time in the popular media that, we're killer apes and that killing is in our genes and warfare is natural. We've always had war, always will have war. I really don't think the data shows that at all. There's actually a convergence of a lot of different types of data that support this, what I like to call a new paradigm or a new perspective, really.
You did mention our closest species, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, and you wrote about them a little bit in the book, and you noted that one is a little bit more aggressive while the other isn't. How does it relate to what we're talking about here?
The bonobos and chimpanzees and humans are basically the three apes, including humans as an honorary ape. We're all equally related to each other, but we're all different species. So we do have our own particular evolutionary trajectories, if you will. chimpanzees tend to be more dominant and more aggressive, and actually Brian may want to have something to say about this too. But the idea is we can't really use either one of those species just in of itself as some sort of model for human. My position is that we should look at our own species and how we behave, have some general frame of reference. Bonobos are rather unaggressive. Chimpanzees have been shown to kill members of other groups in the wild and in captivity. But bonobos in the wild have never been observed to go on any type of lethal raiding and so forth. So one important point there is all of this emphasis has been placed, again, in popular press as well as with some colleagues on chimpanzees as being the species to look to try to get insights about human nature. And I really question that. I'm not saying that we should look at bonobos instead. I'm saying we should just step back from this. And these are different species. We're related to them all. We're obviously unique. So obviously, amongst our closest relatives, we have an ability to be lethally aggressive. And the other species, the bonobos, don't do this. So here we are humans. Yeah, we sometimes do this, but most of the time, actually, we don't do it either. So this is where my studies of hunter-gatherers comes in. If you take a cross sample, a sample of these basic, most archaic type of human societies we spent our human existence in for most of our species past, some of those groups are somewhat aggressive in terms of homicides and so forth. Others are extremely peaceful. So this brings a sort of full circle to your first question about peaceful societies. It's very possible to live without war, without feuding, with very low homicide rates. And in fact, my numbers show that about 29% of the sample of nomadic hunter-gatherers have very low homicide rates and do not engage in war. And if we just are looking at warfare, it's 62% of this sample that I deal with do not engage in warfare. So this sort of is a criticism of this assumption that, yes, whack in the past, there was warfare, and this is in our nature.
Brian Ferguson, you've been prompted. You've also said that this idea of human nature being warlike is empirically unsupportable.
Right. I'll start by responding to the idea about chimpanzees and bonobos. This is a work in progress, and so I don't want to go too far out on it. But my view is that the difference between chimpanzees and bonobos in terms of the intergroup relations and aggressiveness is not as different as, in an inborn sense, as people have thought it to be. There are differences. These two species have been separated by about 2.5 million years of evolution, so there could be hormonal differences that affect their aggressiveness. But when you look carefully at the record about both of these species, you find examples of chimpanzees, especially in some of the very early observations that were done by Jane Goodall at Gombe, two different chimpanzee groups meeting in ways that is virtually indistinguishable from the way bonobo groups have been observed to meet. On the other hand, you have bonobo groups that, although there is not any recorded case of a lethal encounter between two groups, there is a lot of antagonism and sometimes actual physical fighting. There's real differences in the basic female bonding orientation of bonobos, where among chimpanzees, females don't bond in the same way, to the same degree, at least in most cases, although some of them do. So there is a real difference there, but is it something that's built into their genes, hardwired? Or is this a result of long-term adaptive changes associated with different kinds of ecologies? And what I emphasize in my work, the specifics of how human behavior has impacted on their environments, which has been different for bonobos than it's been for some chimpanzee groups.
The other aspect of this notion that war is human nature is empirically unsupportable.
Right.
You actually started with that quote that Barack Obama gave when he took his Nobel Peace Prize, that war in one form or another appears with the first man. You say that's not true. Why?
Well, it's not true. It's a common belief. Everybody, quote, knows it's true. I've been working on the archaeology of war for quite a long time, and I've had people say that to me again and again. You're wrong. People who don't know the archaeology know I'm wrong. It's a projection, modern-day conditions. This has been taken to an intellectual level most recently by Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, draws on two other researchers, Lawrence Keeley and Bowles, and also by LeBlanc. These are people who have written about the antiquity of war, and comes up with a list that supposedly demonstrates that among what they call prehistoric populations, that the average is 15% of the population dies in war, and a quarter of more of the men die in war. And this is the average. The research I've done, I've gone through the cases that they use for this, And there's a lot of problems with what I call Pinker's List. He, for example, counts some cases twice, and he counts three cases where there's one individual who's dead by violence as a case of war, and just can't do that because homicide could be the explanation. The ones that are valid examples of multiple deaths, where you can really say there's at least two people here who've been killed, seeming to indicate war, that these are cherry-picked cases. These are exceptional cases. They do not represent prehistoric people, often from their very violent periods and times, and sometimes within the violent periods and times, they stand out as the most violent of all. So the alternative method of dealing with this is to look at the total archaeological record, which I've done. I've done for North America, I've done for Europe, and I've done for the Near East. And all of the cases that appear in Pinker's List, they're all covered there, but they're put in context. And when you put them in context, what you see is this. The very earliest records we have, the very earliest archaeological remains, which aren't much, we've got maybe 100 pieces of skeletal remains from Paleolithic Europe, that there is one instance of what looks like a violent death of a child. When you come forward in time in this period that's known as the Mesolithic, which is before agriculture, but when you generally had larger populations and more complex societies, then you begin to get in some places, but not others, good signs of war. So it precedes agriculture, but it's very sporadic. And in some places where you have it, later on in the same place you don't have it. When you get to agriculture in Europe, let's just leave it with Europe and the Near East because North America is more complicated. But Europe and the Near East, once you get to agriculture, in most places there's a period that ranges from 500 years to 1500 years where you don't see evidence of war, and then gradually the signs of war begin to appear and become more unmistakable and more developed, more intense, and it's evident, it's obvious. And this is not, as I am often challenged, a case of absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. In other words, people say, because you don't find evidence of war, doesn't mean there wasn't any war there. It means you just haven't found the evidence. War leaves behind lots of archaeologically recoverable traces. And in the archaeological record, there is tons and tons and tons of irrefutable evidence of war out there. What I'm talking about is situations where you've got good archaeological evidence going over very long periods of time, no evidence of war in the earlier phases, good evidence of war in the later phases, without any kind of sharp increase in the recovery. In other words, the amount of material we're getting that could show war isn't getting any better. What's happening is the evidence of war is showing up. And the reasonable inference from that is that war has begun in those areas.
Darsha Novais, you've looked at the cultural aspect and you've compared, say, Western culture with other cultures. What have you found?
Let me just say a few words about the culture that emerged among foraging nomadic bands. It's quite different than what we normally hear from Steven Pinker and others. For example, they really have a companionship culture from the moment of birth on. Every individual in the society is considered part of the self, more of a common self orientation. Animals and other entities are part of that common self, so they have a great respect for the environment, typically. There's a high sense of individualism. People are not coerced into any kind of behavior, even children, and yet they have a great sense of collective group identity in the group that they're in at the time. But they shift in and out of groups, and they're related to others in other groups nearby. They also seem to have a sustainable orientation to life in living as they go from feeding ground to feeding ground nomadically. They do not use up all the resources because they know they're going to have to come back in the next cycle. And they're very cooperative across groups. And there are other characteristics, too. But let me just say that one of the key areas that we have changed from that lifestyle is how we raise children. And my colleagues and I are studying what we call the evolved developmental niche. And this is the caregiving context that our bodies and brains developed to need in relation to the maturational schedule of a baby, for example. And every animal has this developmental niche for their offspring, especially humans because we're born so young with only 25% of the brain in place at birth, full-term birth. And these practices are all now related to health outcomes and well-being outcomes, and my lab is looking at moral outcomes and how they affect moral development in young children. These characteristics include breastfeeding extensively, 2 to 5 years among hunter-gatherer groups. And breast milk, we know, populates the gut with all the proper probiotic bacteria that lead to lifelong health, and has all the immunoglobulins for the immune system to develop, and that takes a while, takes many years to develop that. That's why the breastfeeding lengths in part are so long. Another characteristic is touch. Children are held, carried, and slept with all the time when they're young, and that touch is known to help development as well, and growth, and all sorts of things, calmness. Another one is the responsiveness to the needs of the baby. You don't let babies cry it out, which is quite popular at the moment now. We know that has all sorts of poor effects on children's development in many ways. Another one is free play. Babies are ready to play almost from the day they're born to have a companionship care. Another one is multiple adult caregivers. Moms and dads can't do this alone. Babies need a lot of attention, and 50% of the time in some of these foraging bands, other adults were taking care of the baby, not mother. And then finally, natural childbirth, not in separating mom and baby or interfering with the timing of birth. And we've kind of gone against all these practices in the U.S. in the 20th century, and we're finding that each of these matter for moral development, three-year-olds, empathy development, conscience, self-regulation, and so forth. What happens when you don't have this early care, this evolved developmental niche, your brain systems for self-regulation are undermined. The vagal nerve, for example, doesn't get set properly, and that's related to calming yourself for social relationships, the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that is related to stress response is also misset up. And those things make you stress reactive. And when you're stress reactive, it shuts down the blood flow to the higher order thinking, the neocortex. It shuts down or it decreases compassion. And so you're more likely to be more aggressive.
It kind of leads into where I wanted to go here, which is if, in fact, what your work says is true, which is that war developed and was not necessarily with the first man, as Barack Obama had said, how did we get here? Doug Fry, would you like to start on that?
Basically, it's a social organization feature as I see it. Darsha was talking a bit about the nomadic hunter-gatherers. It's just such a different lifestyle than we're living today in our modern nation states with these populations of, you know, zillions of people that we see every day. It's a little hard, I think, for us in the 21st century to conceptualize just how far we have come, for better or for worse. But Darsha is pointing out that there are many things that were out of touch, I would say, with the way that our species has evolved, and therefore some of our critical needs for morality as well as a whole variety of other behaviors. So we're coming from a situation where basically there was a lot of restraint on the aggression. And the other aspect of the hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle that we're coming from is the disputes tended to be very personal. The disputes are more often than not over a woman, or if someone has been insulted in some way, there's been a theft or something like this. Most of the disputes are actually not lethal. But the idea that there would be a group versus group warfare just doesn't make any sense in terms of the way that the societies are organized. You want to develop friendships, and they do. You want to have connections across group lines. You may need to go over to a neighboring area where there are resources when you don't have those resources. For instance, if there's a drought, you need to move around and have free access to different areas. So some of these ideas that we get in our modern nation states that there are boundaries and that we would defend these borders and we keep people out. Another one is the whole idea of scarcity, a scramble for resources. In fact, the nomadic hunter-gatherers, they share. They're just sharing like crazy within the group and amongst groups. So basically a model that is emerging here is our natural tendencies are to be cooperative, to be sharing, to be very social, like to interact, get positive rewards from interacting in a pro-social way, which is most of social life. I mean, how could it be any different? So the warfare is something that has come rather recently as we've had increase in population and complex social organizations, and especially a shift towards a social hierarchy. Here's yet another feature. These nomadic bands, they tend to be very egalitarian. Males and females are not in a strict hierarchy. Females are doing gathering for the most part, but not exclusively. Males are doing the hunting, but they don't interfere with each other. People get along well. I don't want to oversell this. Of course, there's conflicts and disputes, but they're dealt with through discussion or in sometimes contests. But the point is, the overall pattern is that people need other people, and therefore they're sharing, they're cooperating. They need to do this. And actually, I think there's a real important parallel for our 21st century. We need each other on this planet today. We're very much interlinked with our economies, and especially with global warming. And it's very analogous to the hunter-gatherer band out there in the environment, where you need the people in the next band over. You don't want to go and kill them. Why would you do that anyway? But on our planet today, we are interdependent in some of the same ways that our ancestors have been. And I actually see this as a good reason for hope, that we are really good cooperators. And if we can just manage to get our vision on this, that, oh, okay, we're on the same planet, we're facing very dangerous situations, there's many serious challenges, it's just foolish to get involved with more wars and fight with each other, we really need to work together. So that's sort of my pitch towards the end of this book, actually, in terms of applications.
You mentioned the nation state, and you wrote about this in the book, and about how really relatively new this structure is and how it separated people into this sort of us versus them with these, dare I say, false boundaries.
Yes.
I wanted you to just touch on the development of the nation state and how that affected war in general, but also power and insecurity.
Yes, this is, again, we tend to live in the present and just take for granted that it's always been this way because it's this way now. Nation states are just a few hundred years old, actually. And there's a quotation that I use from Charles Darwin, and I'll just paraphrase it. He talks about the tribes have been able to come together and identify with each other, and then even he's thinking of England, you know, in the 1800s. You have some identity at the nation level at this point, so there's really no reason why then the different races, the different religions, and the different nations could come to a higher identity. And I think actually we're well on the path to that. So you have the nationalism, but at the same time, in the 21st century, you do have emerging higher level of identity with humanity overall. I certainly think this is where we need to go. But humans are very flexible. So we can identify at different levels, and we can identify at different levels simultaneously. So I like to call it expanding the us. It was the us and the them, but who is the us and the them? We're flexible with this. So there didn't used to be nation states. Nobody expanded with something that didn't exist, a nation state. Now we identify with that. But over here in Europe, I'm talking to you from Finland, you know, we have this thing called the European Union, and it's just won the Nobel Peace Prize. It's been very successful at preventing war in Europe. So this is where I think we really need to go now at the global level as well. It's just moved to another level of social evolution here, expand the us to the whole planet, and understand that like our hunter-gatherer ancestors, we need to work together to solve these problems, not fight it out, as we've become accustomed to doing in recent history.
I also think we should go back to a worldview that hunter-gatherers had in the past, and those extant often do today, and that is the sense that the other animals on the planet and other life forms and entities are part of us, and that we are all part of a common self, because we've lost that notion, and that's helping us to easily destroy our habitat now. And if we don't turn back very quickly and soon, we are going to lose ourselves as well.
Brian Ferguson, you've also written about the preconditions of peace.
Right. Your question, how did we get here with all the war? If I'm saying there's a time without war, well, that's obviously long ago. And you can look at that different ways. How do we get to the modern world we live in here in the United States? Or why is it that among tribal peoples we see around the world today, there's so much war? That's undeniable. And I'm saying that those tribal peoples are not the way archaeology says tribal peoples were 10,000 years ago. So why the change? I've written about what I call preconditions for war. These are social conditions which together make the onset of war more likely. And there's a whole list of them, such as leading a more sedentary or settled down existence, or concentrated resources, higher population density, the existence of social and political hierarchy. When I look at modern wars, the focus is always on the political leaders. That's where I think you have to look for understanding modern wars. But these things develop, and they make the onset of war more likely. And these preconditions have gotten more common all over the world over time, over the millennia, which is one reason why war has become so common on planet Earth. But it's not the whole story. There are also preconditions for peace. And these include other social patterns which aren't the same as the ones leading to war, such as patterns of cooperation between different groups, of exchange and trade and intermarriage between different groups, recognize mechanisms of conflict resolution that people can go to, valorization, making valuable peaceful ideals. These things make the onset of war less likely, and it's a different set. You know, you can look at the preconditions for war and the preconditions for peace, and it's a different mix. One of the most fascinating things I found in recent research I did for Doug's book was that one area of the Near East would seem to be very exceptional. It's an area called the Southern Levant. This is the eastern Mediterranean, basically Lebanon, Jordan, parts of Israel, parts of southern Syria. It's an area where plants and animals were first domesticated. We've got excellent archaeological recovery from the area going back to 13,000 years ago. And one of the things that's truly remarkable is that when you look at the other areas of the Near East, like in Turkey or in the northern Tigris area, which is the area that I believe war began in, or look at Europe, you find evidence of war beginning 6,000 years ago, sometimes earlier, certainly within a few thousand years of the onset of agriculture. In the southern Levant, although there are a couple of suspected cases, there's one site that was burned over, and it could have been from an attack, but it could have been from something else. There's a period of about 10,000 years, from about 13,000 B.C. to 3,000 B.C., where there is not one unambiguous case where you can look at it and say, there is war. And you can do that for everywhere else, multiple times, not one single case. And my inference from this, and looking at other aspects of these preconditions for peace, is that those people who first domesticated nature also domesticated conflict. They had certainly good preconditions for war. They had ecological crises, but no signs of war, where in other areas, ecological crises, tons of war. And then it comes to a crashing halt in 3200 B.C., and the area where you can't find one single fortified village, unambiguous fortification for 10,000 years previously, every single area is fortified after 3200 BC. And what happened? The rise of the pharaohs in Egypt. And Egypt had an extensive colony. It had it for 500 years before this in the southern Levant. But now it was an imperial colony. And the Egyptians put up the first wall, and the people of the southern Levant started building their walls at the same time. And this is another thing that got us to where we are in the world today, that when you get expansionist imperial states, it generates warfare among people all around their peripheries. And the prime example of that has been the expansion of the Euro-American system since the time of Columbus, which has generated warfare among tribals in every continent where they've impinged.
That's a very good place to end. Let me thank the three of you. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace. Darshan Narvaez is Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books, including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development. R. Brian Ferguson is Professor of Anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarcircle.org. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.